Welcome back to Catalyze, a podcast from the Morehead Cain Foundation at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Caroline Leland, producer and host. Today, we're releasing the second half of a recorded visit with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author Taylor Branch. Last week, we published a moderated Q&A with him, and now you're about to hear an audience Q&A. This conversation was recorded live during a recent visit Taylor made to the foundation when he was in Chapel Hill to be inducted into the North Carolina Media and Journalism Hall of Fame. A member of the Morehead Cain class of 1968, Taylor is best known for his trilogy of books chronicling the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and much of the history of the American Civil Rights Movement. The first of those books, which is called Parting the Waters, is what won him the Pulitzer Prize. Taylor grew up in Atlanta in the 50s and early 60s. After graduating from Carolina, he earned an MPA from Princeton University. Taylor has worked as an editor and columnist for a number of national magazines. Over the years, he developed a friendship with Bill Clinton, and that relationship continued into Clinton's time in the White House. Taylor later wrote a book titled The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. Taylor's many awards include a MacArthur Fellowship, also known as a Genius Grant, the National Humanities Medal, the Dayton Literary Peace Prize Lifetime Achievement Award, and the Bio Award from Biographers International Organization. Taylor now lives in Baltimore with his wife, Christy. Are there any questions in the audience for Taylor today?
Yeah, I've got a question. When you were here at Chapel Hill, and there was so much going on, civil rights stuff, Vietnam stuff, the all-night debates, people are doing sit-ins around the country, people are marching across bridges. We've got headlines in the papers now, sometimes 10 headlines a day, any one of which should create all-night debates and sit-ins and marches on bridges, and nothing, you know, people get mad and write an angry tweet. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, what's the spark that we had in the 60s? And what was the dry tender that we had in the 60s that somehow now we're, so many of us are sitting around saying, why isn't somebody doing something? I mean, there's the NCAA thing, in addition to, why doesn't somebody do something about that? In addition to all these issues, kids in cages, you can name, like I say, you could probably name 20 that we just are shaking our heads and send out a disappointed tweet, and there's not this collective sense of, let's figure this out and make sure that somebody does something about this. Let's as citizens get active about this. What was present then that doesn't seem to be present now in the same measure?
I'm going to repeat the question for our podcast. So Tom's question was, what factors were at play in the 60s that sparked social movements that we might be lacking today, or what would it take today to spark a movement like we saw in the 60s?
Well, I think it's a really good question. I think it's a hard question. You know, when the sit-in started, Dr. King was the only adult civil rights leader. This is 1960, so this is, 4 years after the bus boycott. He had been frustrated all through the 50s because he thought that the bus boycott should have seeded multiple bus boycotts and moved from one issue to the other, and it didn't. And he preached incessantly, and he said every time he preached, people would cry and say, this is vital, and then he'd wake up the next morning and nothing had changed. And he said he learned from the students when they did the sit-ins that human nature, James Madison said, politics is the most profound meditation on human nature if you're trying to figure out how to do a system that's fair to people. King said the students realize that there are some things in human nature that are so stubborn and so deep that words alone are not enough, and they have to be amplified by sacrifice. And the sit-ins were sacrifice. Of course, he appreciated that in a way that wouldn't be obvious to most of the people that he was saying that to, because he knew that most of these students who were sitting in were the first members of their families ever to go to college, and that they all came out of sharecropper backgrounds, by and large, and that they were the anointed ambassadors to have a better life, and then they put that all at risk by getting themselves arrested in the sit-ins. And he said, this kind of sacrifice is significant because it amplifies the voice and because it shows that nothing really matters if it's all a matter of experts if the citizens don't take hold of it. He said, that's why we're a government of we the citizens. So the sit-ins by students and the fact that college students could be that significant, you know, the first sit-ins were widely considered to be like panty raids. It was such a foreign idea that they could be doing anything significant, let alone anything profound. And Dr. King said it was profound. But nobody predicted that. Nobody predicted that that was going to be the spark. And I don't know what's going to be the spark now, but I do think doing something about it means consciously trying to build a movement, you know, meaning to find that other people, find ways to express that other people share your view and are willing to sacrifice for it too and see this as a profound matter. And none of the, you know, 1%, Wall Street, you know, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, they're all there, but they haven't come to a flashpoint that draws people together into a real movement that grows. You know, I used to say our politics used to be about movement, which is something that starts when you're moved, but then it grows and becomes something that involves lots of other people, so you can literally feel history change. And our politics is about spin, which is really not going anywhere. It's just about the entertainment value of throwing spitballs at each other. And somehow, and I don't really have a good answer, I'm still hoping that something will galvanize. My solace is that nobody predicted, including the bus boycott. Who thought the first major national civil rights story since the Civil War, in many respects, would be over where people sat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and that did not spread, but it ignited, it started raising questions, and people started asking, well, what does that mean, and what's going to happen next, and Dr. King gave all those speeches, and people in those days got names on their Rolodexes, and when the sit-ins started, they all kind of converged, and then that moved to the Freedom Rides, which enlarged the movement and made it mobile. And it took a lot of sacrifice over a lot of time and a lot of all-night meetings trying to figure out what I like about the movement is that in those all-night meetings, they were saying there are secrets in the deep wells of democracy. The only thing that we have to try to figure out a way to put in the faces of people that are trying to avoid this issue. What about equal souls and equal votes, or equal citizenship? What's in the American tradition? Can we do? And the enduring, I don't want to get into a King talk, but the enduring thing about King was that he was so brilliant about putting one foot in the Constitution and one foot in the Scripture, and allowing you to take your pick as to where the inspiration lay, because they were in common ground. And miraculously, somebody who was attacked vigorously on every other issue under the sun was never attacked for mixing church and state, even though he talked about politics and religion every day. And that's because he didn't try to subordinate one to the other. He basically said the same way. So that was a gift. I mean, his gift was to give that kind of oratory. But your question about what sparks citizen action that grows into a common thing rather than just the latest passing fad is a historical mystery.
But you're the seed of a great answer here, I think, the concept of sacrifice, which gives a moral and spiritual weight to the expression of outrage. If we're just expressing outrage, we're being a little self-indulgent if there's no sacrifice attached to that. So I really do think that that's part of the secret.
Well, and from my personal experience, the civil rights movement was scary if you were a white kid in the South. Everybody was scared of it. Black kids were scared of it, too. Most people who say they were right in Martin's movement are lying. You know, they weren't. It was scary. But by the time I was 16, I told my mother that when I got impossibly old and secure, like 30, maybe I would stick my toe in this thing, because this race issue went so deep in all these issues they were talking about. And it seemed like the next week, Dr. King, in the supreme gamble of his life, allowed small children to march in Birmingham into dogs and fire hoses, okay? Now that's sacrificed, but I think those photographs were the emotional turning point for the whole 1960s. They broke the emotional resistance of America. Before that, everybody said, somebody should do something about that. After that, people said, I should do something about that. And it was not just that it was sacrifice, but it was almost shame that if they're doing it, you know, why can I not do it? And because I was watching these, you know, they were mostly girls. They were small girls as young as six, and they're marching into these dogs and fire hoses. And I'm saying, gosh, I've got to, I'm waiting until I'm 30. And what's making them do it? Where did it come from? Which was basically the genesis of the question that made me want to write my trilogy. Where did it come from? I had to go ask them, find out for myself. But yes, so that's sacrifice can be a powerful message, but a complex message, because if people really take it to heart, the question is, well, how does this involve me? If I respect that sacrifice, how does it involve me?
So one of the things that I found most interesting about what you were saying was Clinton seeing himself as a figure in history during his lifetime. That's the reason he got in contact with you in the first place. And I guess my question to you is, what does that say about the psychological profile of Clinton or of any leader? Is that something that you think is common to most people that rise to the presidency or have that vision for themselves, that they are a figure in history, that they see that as an important factor, not just the day-to-day governing of a country? Or do you think that was something specific to Clinton? And did you get any more insight into that over those 8 years in the Clinton White House?
Well, first of all, just as an objective fact, if you're president-elect of the United States, you are a factor in history. So I don't think that reflected that much of his view of himself. But I will say that even back in Texas, Clinton had a strong sense of himself and was very ambitious. We called him a mix. I called him a mix of Elvis and LBJ when we were students. Didn't mean I thought he was going to be president, but he clearly loved politics and he was very ambitious. So not very many people get to be president who are not ambitious. So yes, I think that he had a sense of himself before, a historical sense of himself before he became president, and maybe back even when he was going to Arkansas. I know Hillary told me that she had a sense of herself too, but that she said he wanted to marry her but insisted that she go to Arkansas. And here she is in Washington in the middle of the impeachment hearings on the Nixon impeachment committee, a woman from Chicago and, you know, and the Kleeglites of everything, and Taylor, he wants me to move down there. Have you ever been to Little Rock? You know, because she didn't want to do it. So yes, I think he had that sense all along, but I think once he got into the White House, he deserved it. I mean, what struck me as rare was the way his mind worked. I'm thinking about what the history I'm going to make is, but also how it's going to be preserved, and to take that out three or four more steps. Well, it's going to be preserved with raw materials. What are the raw materials? What's in the library? And what's in the library is not an automatic thing. You know, think about what's in the library. How can I improve that? So his mind was very, very active.
Hi. Hey. So you said that race is central to partisan gridlock, but not to the discussion of it, and how it's fundamentally related to essentially every issue. And I think since today there is a lot of anger and backlash and division regarding conversations of race, I was wondering what your thoughts are on how to make a conversation about race and education about race more accessible and widespread outside of a university and higher education setting, and how we can start those conversations and education in places around the country that might not be having them right now.
Well, I think you should read really good books on the subject, and that you should write good books on the subject if you can to show how it's involved. Look, the main thing is most conversations on race are still kind of prickly, and the unspoken subtext is we need to have this conversation on race, but we need to have it so we can finish it and get back to what we want. That discomfort is a symptom of the problem. that when we're more comfortable understanding that race, that it's part of politics. If you're going to have a conversation about politics, I don't care what it is, if it's about taxes, part of that conversation should be where do public attitudes about race fit in to views on taxes. And I guarantee you they're not irrelevant. On guns, where do people's attitudes about race fit into their attitudes about gun control or not? Did you ever see the NRA protesting stop and frisk policies to take guns away from kids in the inner city? No. You hear them say that we'd all be safer if people took guns into sports stadiums and churches, and that if everybody had an AK-47 to go into their Starbucks, but that's not what they're not thinking about the inner cities then. They're perfectly comfortable with guns. So yes, race is part, I'm not saying precisely how it is, but on any issue that has any voltage, it has a racial element. And often the racial element is the driving element underneath. But you certainly can't have a complete conversation with it. And all I'm saying is that our political discourse now only includes race on an emergency basis when something happens. And you can track it. You can track it on Fox. You can track it on everywhere. When there's an emergency, when Dylann Roof shoots people in Charleston, yes, that's a crisis. You have all these things. But then when that fades, it goes somewhere else.
Taylor, you and I got our Morehead scholarships having gone to a private school in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. That, truth be known, was flourishing at the time because of Brown versus Board of Education and fear of integration. And I know that's had an impact on me emotionally over my life. I suspect it's had an impact on you and the decisions you've made and what to pursue in your scholarship. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, most of the time I was at Westminster, I was just waking up to these things and didn't know very much about it. Although, I will say that being at an elite, you know, I was there to play baseball and football. I was a kid kind of from across the tracks playing there. And by the way, they cut off that scholarship in my 10th grade year. And my dad went and worked out a deal where in exchange for my tuition, we did the laundry for the athletic department every day. So I would drive home with all the dirty socks and towels and stuff and switch cars with him the next day. So it was an elite school. Sports kind of trumped all the class snobbery that was there. And we knew it was segregated, although the school denied that it was segregated. They said they just hadn't had the right black applicant. But the kids were smart enough and the culture had enough sarcasm in it that it really helped expose segregation in the larger society for what it was. The very fact that people that we were taught to respect would say these inane things about how we're not segregated and everything, and everybody could tell we were segregated. You know, I was working in my dad's laundry, so I had a different, and most of the employees were black, and I was conscious and curious of the divides, of the mix of separation and intimacy. You know, I knew them all well. We would go to games together, but I'd never been in their houses and all this sort of stuff. And most of my friends didn't have anything like that. But some of the ones that would be vile in the way they talked about black people would be the very ones that would sneak out at 14 and take their family car and go to Herndon Stadium and hear Ray Charles or go hear Jackie Wilson. There was a bond in early crossover, an emotional bond in black music that transcended politics going. Where did that come from? So my experience at Westminster was all about waking up to all of these mysteries and contradictions and hypocrisy that made it hard for me ever to think about living in Atlanta. I still carry that. Most of my family's still in Atlanta and I love them. And you know, John Lewis and I went to his wedding in the 60s. I have a lot of friends down there, but I still can't live there because I carry all of that stuff about being in an elite school that was clearly segregated, that said it wasn't, that had all these ridiculous attitudes, but there was all this ferment under the scenes about race. So I appreciate the education I got, and I'm still kind of mystified by all the cultural stuff that went on.
So
A couple of answers ago, you mentioned the phrase deep secrets of democracy. And I was wondering if, given your many years of writing about politics and Dr. King and the President Clinton, if you could mention a couple, like what would you view those dark secrets of democracy to be?
I didn't say dark secrets. I said deep wells.
Deep wells.
Deep
sorry.
Wells of democracy. That was one of Dr. King's favorite phrases. And basically, all we've got, we have to reach into the deep wells of democracy in order to be able to appeal to people and get them to see the justice in our cause. Because the deep wells of democracy are the only thing we share, really. And so, I'm writing about this now, but in a very short way because my books are not short. I'm going to try to say, I think the movement got, and I'm not talking about checks and balances and the structure of the Constitution and stuff like that, but if you read James Madison's discussions in the Federalist Papers and even his private letters about why democracy failed, why for 2,000 years every attempt to have representative government had failed, which is basically what he did before he designed the Constitution. He said that they always failed because traditional government, monarchy, hierarchical government, proceeds on the basis that the monarchs, the rulers, have faith only in themselves and that they have to discipline their subjects. And that that discipline and loyalty is what cements politics. And he said, as a psychological bet, democracy is, as strange as this might seem, it's upside down. It's believing that people can govern themselves and build up trust in strangers, build up trust in other people. But just upside down from all, you know, Madison said, all our political experiments rest on the capacity of mankind for self-government, meaning individually and collectively, that we can have some sort of, you can think of self-discipline, self-restraint, combined with public trust, meaning believe that other people have self-restraint, believe that you have bond, that you can consider everything you're doing. So Dr. King, that's the reason that he loved the sit-in students so much, because he said, nobody has more self-government and belief in public trust than a freedom rider who's about to get hit by a Klansman and says, what ye do to me may not build any bonds of citizenship between you and me, but I believe it will between our children and grandchildren. That I'm going to have the discipline to make this witness in order to build public trust. So he's saying that the sit-in movement exhibited things from the deepest wells of democracy in that sense. And that also that it was citizen responsibility, that it's not just we petition, we want to elect a better president, or we petition, or even just that we vote, but that we are also citizens every day. So if you take self-government, public trust, and citizenship in we the people, you know, I've always said the preamble of the Constitution is only one sentence, but it is just staggeringly optimistic and broad. You know, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. One sentence. But if it were repeated before the beginning of every debate, it would be very hard to get back into our comfortable cynicism, because it's kind of saying that the essence of America, on top of self-government and public trust, is a citizen involvement with an optimism about what we're doing. Clinton always, by the way, used to say that, speaking of psychological underneath, that he viewed the underlying mission of his presidency was to restore some measure of optimism about what people could accomplish through national politics from the cynical era of government is bad. And he said, Taylor, you and I understand that. It's rare. But he said, it's because not many, we're Southerners who believe that the Civil Rights Movement was good for the white South, in addition to the justice that it set in motion for other people. And in that sense, that it's good. But he said, my pollsters tell me that you can predict votes with over 90% accuracy, this is in the 1990s, I don't know how it holds up, by asking one question. On balance, do you think the 1960s were good or bad for America? So it's that same thing. If you think the 60s were bad for America, you're going to vote Republican. If you think the 60s were good for America, you're going to vote Democratic. And I hope I don't have to tell you that there's a racial subtext in there, because that's what the 60s were about, by and large. So anyway, and on top of that, the last thing that Dr. King had was, and it's part of the Constitution, but he had an irrational optimism. It wasn't a Pollyanna optimism. If you ever hear the tone of his voice, it's anguished, because he was a realist. He knew what he was up against. But he had, and he shared this with Frederick Douglass. He shared it with a lot of Ida B. Wells, a lot of the orators and writers from that time had an irrational optimism, which they think is also part of the deep wells. And you hear it in the Constitution. So self-government, public trust, citizenship responsibility, and optimism, I would say, are kind of the non-technical, not checks and balances, components of the deep wells that he's talking about.
Well, thank you so much for your time and your thoughts, Taylor.
You've been listening to Catalyze, a podcast from the Morehead Cain Foundation at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Once again, we're grateful to Taylor for visiting us in person at the foundation and for sharing his thought-provoking ideas. Thanks also to Creighton Irons, Morehead Cain Class of 2005, for our fantastic theme music. You can find more of Creighton's work at creightonirons.com. That's CREIGHTONIRONS.com. If you like what you've been hearing on Catalyze, please tell your friends and then rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That helps other people find us. Thank you, as always, for listening.